So in these talks we've been looking at the mind, and we've been providing ourselves with the tools for Dharma Vichaya, for investigating mental events, for getting to know our minds. And as I've said, I think that there are two purposes behind this. First of all, as a basis for self-knowledge. So as a result of watching our minds in the light of these formulae, we're clearer about what's going on in our minds and therefore clearer about what we need to work on. And secondly, the examination of our minds in the light of these formulae gives us a basis for deeper communication, especially deeper communication within our chapters. So in this first part of the event, we've been looking at the way the mind works, at the basic structure of the mind. Especially yesterday we looked at the five Savatraga Chaita Dharmas, the universal or omnipresent mental events, Sparsha, Vedana, Sanya, Chetana and Manaskara, which form the basic mechanisms of the mind, without which no consciousness is present. And we saw that these are approached as undetermined. In other words, they're neither skillful nor unskillful. They're not approached as either clear or unclear. But they're susceptible to being either skillful or unskillful, or becoming more clear or less clear. That is the three that are karmically based. The next five mental events that we're going to deal with today are also undetermined. They are in themselves neither skillful nor unskillful. And they're also to do with the basic mechanisms of the mind. And they really are intensifications of the five that we've already looked at. They're to do with how we get more deeply involved with the objects of our perception. The five that we dealt with yesterday are just to do with the way in which objects are made conscious. These five are to do with the way in which they're made more conscious. We get more deeply involved with them, closer up to them. So let's just remind ourselves of the five Savatraga mental events and how they work. We've got Sparsha, first of all, which gives us the basic presentation of object to consciousness. We've got Vedana, which is the hedonic evaluation of that presentation to consciousness. We've got Sanya, which is the recognition, identification of the object as distinct from other objects and its labelling in the light of previous experience. We've got Chetana, which is the whole drive of the mind, of the personality, of the being, on the basis of Sparsha, Vedana and Sanya. And we've got Manaskara, which is the final grasping of the object. It's the sort of the completion of the movement that Chetana begins in an act of conscious attention. One moment of conscious attention. But yes, the question is how do we get closer up to the object? How do we discriminate it more clearly? How do we enter more deeply into the object? How do we, in the end, understand the object as it really is? How do we intensify our experience of the object to the point at which we see it in its ultimate nature? Whether the basis is skillful or not, these five Vinayata Chaita Dharmas initially can be considered whether the basis for using them is skillful or not. For any successful enterprise in life, we need to get more deeply involved with the objects of our perception. And whether that enterprise is skillful or not makes no difference. These five Vinayata Chaita Dharmas will come into play to some extent. They represent our intensified engagement with the objects of our experience. So, I'll first of all look at them in broad detail, just as neutral elements or undetermined elements, that is, ethically undetermined elements, which can be used in an unskillful consciousness, in an unhealthy citta, or they can be used in a healthy one. So the first of the five vinyata chaita dharmas, vinyata meaning specifying, determining, making more distinct. The first of these is chanda, which is a word probably familiar to you, especially in the context of the contrast between kama chanda and dharma chanda. And that is, of course, the difference between chanda used for unskillful purposes and the chanda used for skillful purposes. Chanda that's directed towards sensuous experience in the sense of craving, and chanda that's directed towards the dharma. So chanda means something like interest or fascination. It means emotional engagement. It means a very strong interest and desire towards whatever the object is. And it's obviously the essential basis for any successful enterprise, for any further or deeper engagement. You have to want to get involved with the object. You have to have, so to speak, emotional drive towards it. And that applies to whether you're robbing a bank or trying to pass an exam or trying to gain enlightenment. Chanda is necessary to all of those enterprises. You have to really sort of feel interested in robbing the bank. You have to feel really interested in passing your exam. You have to feel really interested in spiritual life. So it's the movement of one's emotions towards that object, wanting to be with it, wanting to stay with it, and considering that that object is worthwhile to you, so to speak. So this is clearly a form of chetana. It's the movement of the being towards the object. But that only takes us so far. A mere interest or engagement, emotional engagement, doesn't take us very deep. We need also adimoksha, which is resolve or commitment, even conviction. It's the feeling that it's not just a feeling of attraction, it's a feeling that this is definitely what I want to get involved with, what I want to do. Going with it is a kind of intellectual conviction. The absence of doubt about that object as being worthwhile, as being what you need to get involved with. This is the right thing to be doing now, and I will do it. And again, that applies to whether you're trying to rob a bank, pass an exam, or lead the spiritual life. If you want to rob a bank, well, you've got to make up your mind to do it. There's no good just sort of feeling like doing it. You've actually got to set your heart on it, as it were, to commit yourself to it. And the same with an exam. You won't just drift through the exam. You have to make up your mind to do it. Exam is supposed to be a neutral example, by the way. And the spiritual life, too. Of course, you need to actually commit yourself. Otherwise, well, you just feel some attraction, you feel some interest, but when that interest comes up against difficulties, well, you give up. But you also need smriti. You need mindfulness in the sense of not forgetting. The root meaning of smriti is memory. And here what it means is retaining the object in your mind, so that your mind does not wander from it. You don't forget it. You continually come back to it if you do forget it. This is really the essential meaning of smriti, of mindfulness. It's remembering recollection, continually keeping that object in front of you. It's the continuity of conscious attention. And again, you need that if you're going to rob a bank, pass an exam, or lead the spiritual life. I think I probably don't need to illustrate. You just need to keep on remembering what you're doing and keep yourself focused on it. Otherwise, you will not achieve it. The next one is not so easy to see in a broad way, partly because the word samadhi, which is the fourth of the vinyata chaita dharmas, is usually used as applied to meditation states, jhanic states. But it's also used more broadly. For instance, I remember Bhante saying once that you could talk of a cat watching a mouse hole, waiting for the mouse to come out, as having mithya samadhi, wrong concentration. So there is concentration there, there is focus, even in a sense absorption. All the energies that it's possible to concentrate in an unskillful way could be concentrated. So samadhi represents deep concentration and absorption in the objective. It's a sustained engagement which has become so deep and steady that it's quite unshakable. And again, you need that to rob a bank. Otherwise, you'll forget what you're doing. You'll drift away from it. You won't have a single-mindedness. Perhaps you could even talk of samadhi in the sense as single-mindedness. And you need it to pass an exam and to lead the spiritual life. Although, when it comes to the spiritual life, one has to take samadhi onto another level altogether. So, we've got chanda, adimoksha, smriti and samadhi. Chanda, the basic interest. Adimoksha, the commitment. Smriti, the sustained recollection of the object. Samadhi, the absorption in it. Then we've got prajna, the last, prajna. We usually translate prajna as wisdom, but that is a quite applied meaning in early Buddhist tradition. Prajna is also used much more broadly just for penetrative understanding, even intellectual understanding, analytical intelligence, something like that. And clearly, if you are to succeed in any enterprise, you need to think about it, you need to analyse it, you need to understand what you're doing, at least in the mundane and functional sense. You need to penetrate behind the appearances, you need to really investigate deeply what it is that you're trying to do, what it is that you want, the nature of the object, how to engage with it and so forth. So prajna too is necessary to robbing a bank, passing an exam, or to leading spiritual life. So we can see all of these five as present in any systematic endeavour. Whatever it is we're trying to do, if it requires more than momentary attention, we'll call upon one or more of these five. And we call upon them to greater or lesser extents. Some of us probably are more sort of gifted in one than another. And you could say sometimes you can see that enterprises that fail, it's for lack of one or other element. Somebody may have a brilliant sort of prajna-like analysis of the situation, but there's no adimoksha, there's no commitment. Or, probably more likely with many of us, there's lack of smriti. We just forget what we're trying to do. You see that very, very much, that people often, they really do work out what they need to do. They even feel a certain degree of commitment to it, but they don't remember to keep it up. There's not sufficient continuity of individuality, continuity of purpose to carry out the enterprise. So at the mundane level, world of ordinary discourse, or ordinary experience, these five do come into play. We're using them to some extent all the time. But they're especially necessary for spiritual life, and especially for meditation within spiritual life. And they do, when looked at in this light, represent a kind of spiral path of progressive and deepening engagement with the objects of meditation, and more broadly, with the objects of spiritual life, the objects for which spiritual life is lived. So that by sort of deepening the Vinayata Chaitadharmas progressively, we become closer and closer to the object, we see the object more and more close up, and eventually we penetrate through to its real nature, to what the object is in its ultimate reality. And this, of course, illustrates the whole course and progress of spiritual life itself, so that the list both can be applied to meditation practice and it can be applied to our spiritual lives in general, a bit like the spiral path of the 12 Nidanas. And I think it's a very, very helpful schema, both in that general sense and in the specific one. I think that if we truly get to grips with the theory of the five vinyatas, we can probably find a way of applying it in our own personal meditation practice. You can begin to see where you've got to work in order to go deeper in your meditation practice. And I think that it's these that Tejananda is going to be examining in the sessions in the latter part of the morning and in the evening over the next few days, so that you'll get a chance to try to see these Vinayata Chaita Dharmas in your experience and see how you can use them to take your meditation practice deeper. Actually, I think that they really deserve a lot more attention from us. I've just come back from India, where I did a 10-day retreat just on the five Vinayata Chaita Dharmas, and we spent one day on each Vinayata, and I've decided that next time I go back, I'm going to spend 10 days just on Chanda, because it seemed as if that was the most difficult, and, well, if you hadn't got that right, the rest don't follow. So I thought that we'd experiment and try to see much more clearly how to get Chanda involved. Because if you've got no, well, emotional equivalence for your intellectual understanding in Bhante's terms, if you've got no emotional zest for spiritual life, it's not going to unfold. If you've got no zest for meditation, it won't unfold. So I think it's extremely important to get Chanda going. But then the other Vinayata Chaita Dharmas, I think, are very helpful indeed as well. They really are extensions of and applications of and deepenings of Chanda. Like all spiral paths, the elements are not discrete. Each one is the fulfillment of the previous one. In one of the accounts in Anguttara Nikaya of the spiral path, the Buddha says Pamoja is Shraddha, Sadha, made much of. So that the succeeding stage is the preceding stage made much of, so that it becomes something much fuller and richer. It becomes something, in a sense, distinct, but which is really simply the fulfillment of the preceding stage. So Chanda, in a way, goes right the way through, but each of the succeeding stages is the fulfillment of Chanda. So I'm now going to go over these five Vinayata Chaita Dharmas from the point of view of their application in spiritual life and their application especially to meditation. And I'm going to treat them as a spiral path. But do remember that they're operating all the time and not necessarily in a spiral-like formation. They are there whenever we intensify our experience of the objective world around us and inside us, our imagination. So first of all, we have Chanda, which, as I've said, is interest or fascination or attraction, emotional engagement. It's the connection of Chetana to the object of meditation, to the objectives of our spiritual life. And it's characterized by the desire to be involved with the object and to stay involved with it. Just by the way, of course, there's in other contexts, you can talk of Chanda as aversive. There's a desire not to be involved with certain objects. And even, you could say, in the spiritual context, there's a kind of reverse Chanda for worldly things, for objects of contaminated objects, as we've described them, or unreal objects, as we described them yesterday. So there's a sense of desire for renunciation. So Chanda has also a reverse side, which is renunciation. But anyway, here it's most easy to think of Chanda in terms of an attraction to the object, a desire to stay with the object, to be with the object. So if you're focusing on the breath, you feel you want to be with the breath, and you want to stay with the breath. You're interested in it, you're fascinated by it, you're attracted to it. And presumably not just because you know it's good for you, so to speak, but because you're sort of intrinsically interested in the breath. the sensuous qualities, the purified sensuous qualities of the breath are interesting to you, are attractive to you. So it's maybe initially a question of sort of having a feeling to do meditation because you see where it leads you, but there must be some actual engagement with the object itself, not with the idea of the object or the idea of doing the concentration of on the object. So I think there's a quite interesting area of exploration there. How do you translate your sort of generalized desire to meditate into a specific desire to engage with that particular object? There's quite an interesting and rich field of investigation of chanda in that sense. Because sometimes you can feel really strongly that you want to meditate, but you can't get engaged with the breath or whatever it is. So you want to be involved with it, and you want to stay involved with it. Well, the whole art of spiritual life is getting chanda hooked up to our spiritual objectives, and the whole art of meditation is getting our interest, our fascination, our desire hooked up with the object of the meditation practice. It's not a straightforward matter by any means, and there's a considerable amount of self-knowledge required in order to do it, unless you're very lucky and there's just a sort of spontaneous interest. And we have to exercise quite a bit of cunning to get our feelings hooked up with the object of meditation. Quite a lot of good fortune is involved as well, I think. And probably a lot of our effort is in setting up the right circumstances so that our interest flows quite naturally into the object of meditation, and more broadly so that it flows into our spiritual practice in general. A lot of that's to do with environment and context, setting up the context so that interest easily engages, being in an environment which is suitable to engagement. If you're in a very ugly setting, it sort of blunts your chanda. You feel a kind of sense of repulsion to what's around you, so it's difficult to get a positive sense of engagement. Lifestyle makes obviously an enormous difference. If your lifestyle is one that really encourages the hindrances, even in itself is a nivarana bhavana, is a kind of almost systematic development of the hindrances, well, when you sit to meditate, you're not going to find your chanda flowing towards the object of meditation because it's going to be off in the hindrances. So lifestyle and a certain amount of discipline in one's lifestyle are bases for developing chanda. But again, that has to be cunningly done, because if you over-constrain yourself, well, your interest will go into reverse. It will just revolt. It won't do what you want it to do. Friendship, very, very important indeed. Friendship especially with those who share your desire to have chanda for the objects of meditation, for spiritual life in general. Arts and culture, so that your chanda is somewhat refined. I think a lot of the trouble that people have with meditation is that their general emotional and mental functioning is quite crude. So that when you come to meditate, you've got no sort of natural affinity with the more refined objects of meditation. So engagements in culture in general, arts in particular, can help one to refine one's emotions so that one's chanda does naturally have an affinity with the more subtle objects of meditation. So all of this helps to create emotional engagement, which is the key to the whole enterprise. If we want to meditate, we've got to engage chanda with our practice. If it's not there, well, we won't get anywhere, or we won't get very far, and we've got to ask ourselves, why not? Where is chanda? What is it that chanda is going into? Because it's surely going into something. We are interested, we are engaged in something. Often what we're engaged in, what our feelings really flow towards, doesn't easily then make the transition to practice of meditation, even the spiritual life in general. But at the same time, we can't just sort of cut it off and force ourselves to be interested in meditation. There has to be a very skillful and almost seductive weaning of the whole emotional life so that it flows into meditation. We need to ask, why not? Why is it not there to the extent that it's not there? And we need to ask ourselves, what are we to do to make it go there? So I think that this sort of consideration is already going to make us much sharper and clearer about our spiritual lives. If we just examine ourselves to see how readily chanda flows into spiritual practice in general, and meditation in particular, and we ask ourselves, well, if it doesn't, or to the extent that it doesn't, where is it? And when we've begun to sense where it is, well, how do we get it to move in a natural and harmonious and healthy way into the meditation practice? We need to work out what we're going to do about it. If we don't do that, well, we can make efforts on other levels, but there's always going to be something that's pulling in another direction. There's always going to be a sense of division. We're not going to be able to engage beyond a certain point. So chanda really is the key, and there's an awful lot that could be said about it. There's a whole series of reflections that one could have. And I think that probably that's where we need to start in our reportings in, if we want to. Just talking about where chanda is and what the state of chanda is in relation to the meditation practices that we're doing during this event. And how we might right now get more chanda engaged with the practice. Get more interest, more fascination, more desire, more emotional engagement. And then, of course, to reflect more broadly what the implications of that are for our lives outside this event. Chanda really is the key, it seems to me. And if we don't address chanda, well, we probably will find that we're always shooting ourselves in the foot. That's not quite the image I was looking for, but undercutting ourselves, or sort of walking in two directions. And yes, it requires a considerable degree of skill and sensitivity to our own emotional life to get chanda flowing successfully into spiritual practice. But as I've already said in the general context, chanda itself is not enough. You do see people who obviously and sincerely feel attracted to meditation, or feel attracted again to spiritual life, and you can't doubt that there is some real emotion there. There is some emotional engagement, but there doesn't seem to follow anywhere. And that often is because there's a lack of adimoksha or commitment. They haven't really made up their minds and set themselves to the task, so that there's a constant sort of wavering, there's a constant doubt, which undercuts and even sort of destroys whatever chanda is there. Adimoksha has two principal aspects. The first is, so to speak, cognitive. It's to do with being convinced that the object is the object that you should be concentrating on, that it's worthwhile, and that, as it were, through the object you can attain what you want to attain. It's the means to your objectives. So it's a feeling of conviction. It's most commonly spoken of as absence of doubt. So you don't think, while you're attracted to the object and while you're focusing on it, well, maybe I shouldn't be. Maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe this isn't the right thing. You're quite convinced that you should be doing the practice that you're doing. And I think it's quite important to sort of examine oneself in this respect, because doubt can become habitual, and you therefore don't even notice it. You don't notice that subtly all the time you're sort of wondering whether really you shouldn't be doing some other practice, wondering whether actually maybe you should be following something completely different, or whether you're just wasting your time. That sort of subtle subvocal doubt can be going on, and it will, of course, undermine one's efforts and destroy or dry up chanda. Of course, if you have that sort of doubt, well, then you need to clarify what its basis is. it's traditionally said that one needs to examine doubt in terms of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and of the practice itself, and of the context within which you're practicing. So that if you of course have doubt in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that's fairly straightforward. That's going to undermine your spiritual efforts. You're not going to be able to have adimoksha. You're not going to be able to commit yourself. But yes, you may have doubt in the practice itself. You may think, well, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are wonderful, but the mindfulness of breathing, I'm really not sure whether it's the right practice for me, or whether, you know, this is actually how the Buddha taught it. I've heard somewhere else they do it in five stages and they do it like this. Maybe that's how it ought to be done. So that sort of doubt can undermine your practice. But also in some of the suttas, the Buddha says that lack of confidence in your fellow Brahmafarers can undermine your practice, so that you feel that the very community in which you're practicing is not, you're not confident in it, and that undermines the practice that you're doing with them. So one needs to identify where the source of lack of confidence is, where the doubt is, and clarify it. So that's the first aspect of adimoksha. It consists in absence of doubt, of conviction, which means that then your chanda can fulfill itself, so to speak, in the second aspect of adimoksha, which is commitment. So that having convinced yourself, you dedicate yourself to activating your commitment, your conviction, acting on your conviction. So this is adimoksha. It's the absence of doubt and the commitment to acting upon one's convictions. When you are convinced of the value of the practice, you commit yourself to it. That is adimoksha. And often, when we're meditating, we're not altogether aware of the extent to which these sort of the lack of adimoksha is undermining us. So if you're finding that you're not concentrated, well, you need to start asking, is it because I'm not really convinced? It could be, of course, lack of chanda. But if chanda is there, well, maybe lack of conviction is there, lack of commitment is there. Maybe there's not enough adimoksha. So one needs to work at developing a strong faith in and confidence in the practice, and really making up one's mind to pursue it. I know in some states of mind you can spend a whole meditation sort of working out whether to do the practice or not, and it's gone and you've not really made up your mind. You may even have sort of nominally made up your mind, but really when it comes down to it, you're not actually applying yourself. So adimoksha is clearly a vital step once one has chanda. Without chanda, of course, adimoksha is not going to be there. Or it may be just a sort of very thin layer of adimoksha. So then, even adimoksha is not enough. You may have a strong feeling for the practice. You may have even a strong conviction in it and commitment to it. But you just don't have the mental sort of muscles to keep it up. You don't have the individuality, you don't have the smriti. You're not able to remember what it is that you committed yourself to. You commit yourself, but you can't sustain it. You just cannot bear in mind what you've committed yourself to. This is quite humiliating, I know from personal experience, when you really feel sort of very strongly motivated to do the practice, you sort of dedicate yourself to it, and then you go and do something else. Because your mind just drifts away. Perhaps you could say it's lack of chanda, lack of adimoksha, but it also seems to be a lack of mental training, as it were. One hasn't learned to sustain one's attention, one's focus. Perhaps because of the circumstances of life, one may be giving in far too much to distraction and to superficial activity, without really keeping a strong underlying thread of mindfulness, of continuity of purpose, so that when you come to meditate, your habits will take over. You're just dot here and there, and you won't be able to maintain your really strongly felt desire to do the practice and your conviction in it. So smriti is your holding your mind to the practice, not in any very sort of intensive sense. It's not jhana at this stage. It's initial concentration. It's just sort of remembering, so to speak, not to forget the practice. Just keeping your attention on the object of concentration. And it does follow from Chanda and Adimoksha. You're interested in the object, you're committed to it, so you stay with it. You keep the object steady before you. You don't let it waver. You don't let your mind drift away from it. I think that that often Smriti is what lets us down, speaking quite personally. I think that quite often there is Chanda, at least to some degree, and Adimoksha to some degree, but there is this sort of lack of mental training and habituation to a scatteredness of mind, so that it becomes very difficult to hold a focused attention. And we need to work a lot outside meditation if we're to successfully maintain Smriti within meditation. I've come myself more and more to think that the key to meditation lies outside meditation. A lot of the time we think that we ought to be able to just sit down and meditate. But of course what happens when we do that is all the mental habits that we've been developing during the previous hours and days and years and months and years just comes into play. After all, when you're meditating, it's not some special mind that you're meditating with, it's just your mind, your ordinary mind, the mind that you've been sort of cultivating, developing in the rest of your life. So I think that especially this comes home to roost with Smriti. You can really see that you just haven't got sufficient continuity of awareness in your ordinary life to be able to take it even deeper in your meditative life. But anyway, if we are successfully going up this spiral path, if we've got Chanda, that Chanda has eventuated in Adimoksha, if that Adimoksha has led to Smriti, well, we're getting more and more deeply involved with the object. We're getting closer and closer up to the object. It's as if Chanda sort of gets us to look at it. Adimoksha gets us to decide to intensify our engagement with it. Smriti is our holding to the object so that we can see it more fully and deeply. And of course, by the time you get to Smriti, the hindrances have been left behind because, well, you're so much absorbed in the object, or rather you've so much focused your mind on the object that the hindrances don't come into play. And yes, at this stage, one can start to use the Vinayata Chaitadharmas to deepen meditation. If you find that your mind is wandering, well, you ask yourself, have I got enough Adimoksha? Am I really convinced enough? If you find that you're not really convinced enough, well, you need to go back and ask, well, is Chanda in play? Is Chanda flowing? Once you've got Chanda flowing, then you sort of strengthen Adimoksha. Once you strengthen Adimoksha, you strengthen Smriti. So in this way, one can use the Vinayata Chaitadharmas to analyse what's going on in your meditation and see where it is that you need to put in work if you're not adequately concentrated. You can strengthen the preceding stages when you realise you're weak in a succeeding one. Because like all of these spiral formulations, you can only really complete the succeeding stage when the preceding one is completed. So if Smriti is weak, if Adimoksha is weak, Smriti will not be strong. It cannot be strong. Smriti does represent a much deeper engagement with the object insofar as you're holding it steady before you and you're not contaminating the object with the kleshas in the form especially of the hindrances. So what you're seeing is an uncontaminated object, but you're not at this stage penetrating beyond the sort of ordinary perception of the object. Clear up some spiders for a moment. You're still relatively separate. Here are you, and here is the spider. Here is the object of your meditation. There's a quite definite sort of distinction between subject and object. They exist in separate worlds, you might almost say. But with samadhi, you pass into a much more intimate relationship with the object of concentration. Subject and object come into a much deeper dialogue. They begin to merge with each other. Samadhi here does mean one-pointedness, ekagata. It represents elevation above the karmaloka, because what you are experiencing is not the gross, ordinary object as sort of located within space and time of an ordinary kind, of the sensuous kind. You're relating to the object in its subtle dimensions, in its purified dimensions, so that you cease to experience it as a purely sensuous object. You experience it in terms of the rupaloka. I went into this yesterday when I talked about the transition within samnya, so I'm not going to talk about that very much. But samadhi does represent that definite sort of shift in consciousness where you become deeply absorbed in the object because the object has become for you a much more subtle one, and you therefore have become a much more subtle subject. And subject and object, subtle object, sort of speak to each other much more intimately, much more closely, and that the interrelationship between them is much more subtle and even rapid, you could say. Samadhi also represents a unification of faculties, so that it's not just one aspect of you attending to the object, it's all your energies locked onto the object, absorbed in the object. With concentration up until that point, it's so to speak merely the conscious energies. This is perhaps what you could say with smriti. It's your conscious attention to the object. Whereas with samadhi, it's the total energies which are now focused on the object. I should point out that I'm talking at the moment in terms of samadhi as focus upon an object, but Xuan Sun speaks of samadhi also as referring to not fixation upon an object or not absorption in an object, but absorption in whatever your mind attends to, if you see what I mean. So that, for instance, in the Dhammavichaya that we've been doing, you're attending to whatever is going on in your mind, and theoretically at least, one could be doing that in samadhi, so that different objects may be coming into your mind, but you would still be entirely concentrated and absorbed. Of course, they wouldn't be just distractively floating through if you were genuinely in samadhi. And it's in this sense, of course, that you can reflect in samadhi. You can take something and reflect upon it, but with full concentration. So samadhi takes us very close up to the object indeed, and in samadhi is sort of infinitely extensible. You can become more and more and more deeply absorbed in samadhi as you go up through the dhyanas and the arupa dhyanas. It's as if the subject and object get closer and closer together. But I remember Bhante saying once that it's as if they get closer and closer together, but they never meet. You could an infinite extension of samadhi does not break the subject-object distinction. It's like two asymptotic curves, which the nearer they get to each other, they get nearer and nearer to each other, and they meet at infinity, which of course never comes. So subject and object in samadhi do become very, very close, but just in samadhi, just samadhi itself, does not take one beyond that bifurcation of experience. There's still in samadhi a fundamental dichotomy, even though it's attenuated and even can be highly attenuated. So in order to go deeper, you need to bring something else to bear. You need to bring prajna to bear on the object, and you need to bring a sort of analytical intelligence to bear upon your experience, upon your immediate experience, backed by the weight of your energies, all your energies, unified and purified by samadhi. So with the energies that have been accumulated and refined and purified through samadhi, you turn your attention to reflection upon the object of concentration, if you know, following it through in that sort of sense of looking at one object. And you begin to reflect on the nature of that object, especially in the light of the lakshanas. That's what prajna basically boils down to. It boils down to applying the lakshanas to your experience. Prajna is the sword that cuts through the veil of views. It cuts through the delusions that maintain an idea of a separate object and separate subject as really existing. So with prajna, with the active reflection upon your experience on the basis of the purified consciousness and elevated consciousness, concentrated consciousness of samadhi, you penetrate through to the real nature of the object. You see that it is impermanent. You see that it is without an abiding substance. You recognize that if it is craved, it will lead to suffering. You see it as dependently arising. You see it as shunya, and so on. So prajna is the pinnacle of the whole process. It is specifically, it's not so much the product of the process, but it's the final step of the process in this particular usage. Prajna breaks you through into wisdom, and it's the application of systematic reflection on the lakshanas, on the object in the light of the lakshanas. So with that, you finally break through the separation that isolates you from the object, and you come through to the way things really are. So you can see how the five vinayata chaitadharmas represents a way of understanding, arriving at the truth, whereby you learn to focus yourself. You learn, first of all, to attract yourself to the object. You learn to dedicate yourself to it. You learn to keep your mind on it. You learn to absorb your mind on it, and then you're able to see it as it really is. The idea is, I suppose, that most of the time we don't really pay proper attention to our experience. For a start, what we're paying attention to often is a contaminated object. That is an object that is distorted by craving or hatred, or the other kushala chaitadharmas, klesha chaitadharmas. So what we're attending to is an object that's already mixed up with negative feelings and so on. Even if we can clear them away, what we're attending to is, to some degree, an unreal object. So what we have in our minds is not the object itself, but our construction of it in terms of its permanence, its substantiality, and its satisfactoriness. So most of the time, this sort of idea rests upon this interpretation, that we're not seeing things properly. We're either seeing them in the light of our own subjective craving and hatred and so on, all the various attenuations of them, or we're seeing them in a distorted way, fundamentally distorted way, misinterpreting them in terms of, in the light of our belief in a permanent, abiding self, which stands outside the experiencing situation, and permanent abiding objects which stand outside the experiencing situation, of which experiences are experiences. So we're all the time deluded in this way, whether grossly deluded by the veil of klesha, or subtly deluded by the veil of jnaya. And the five vinayata chaitadharmas take us gradually through the process of breaking the veils. First of all, the first four really are to do with breaking through the klesha avarana, the veil of our negative emotions, our clinging, our craving, and our hatred, and so on. So that we learn first of all just to get interested. We learn to commit ourselves. We learn to pay attention, and then we can, as it were, surmount the kleshas in samadhi. With samadhi, we leave the kleshas behind. And of course, involved in this also is the whole practice of Sila, because through Sila we're learning to at least not let the kleshas affect our body and speech. But with Samadhi we really take it much deeper and we purify our minds. But with Prajna we break through the Nyayavarana. We sweep away the veil that hides the truth from us at this deepest level. So I myself find this a very, very useful way of looking at spiritual life. Of course, it's never quite as tidy as this, but it's such a sort of broad kind of schematization that I found it very, very helpful indeed. And I personally found it especially useful in meditation. One can use the Vinayata Chaitadharmas as a means of getting into meditation, as a sort of formula, if you like, for getting into meditation. You can systematically try to get chanda engaged. You can learn how to bring your chanda into your meditation. Once you've got that, well, you make sure that you're really convinced that you're doing what you should be doing and that you understand what you're doing, and you make sure that you're really fully committed to it. And then you set up quite deliberately smriti. And if you find at any stage that you've lost it, so to speak, well, you could go back. And if that stage is still not firm enough, well, you go back again. You probably find quite a lot of your time in chanda, at least I do. But you can use them as definite working tools to build up the sort of edifice of meditation practice. And I'm sure we'll be seeing this in the sessions that are going to happen in the late morning and in the evening. But one of the things I find most interesting about the formulation is the way it puts prajna as the pinnacle of the edifice. And I found this especially useful myself. It's made me realise that I need to more systematically use every meditation session to do some reflection. And especially reflection on whatever it is I've been meditating on. So that I use the engagement that I've got with the object as a basis for deeper reflection upon it. So I've myself, since coming across this list and thinking about it and sort of exploring it, I've been quite systematically at the end of each meditation session taking up the prajna element, even if I haven't got very much samadhi. Nonetheless, trying to sort of accustom myself to reflecting upon it. So for instance, if you're doing the mindfulness of breathing, you'd get yourself into the mindfulness of breathing by using the first three especially, and hopefully when you become absorbed, passing into samadhi. And at the end of the practice, after the fourth stage, you just start to turn your mind to the breath in a more reflective way. You'd start to think, well, this breath, it's impermanent. It comes, it goes. And anyway, I say breath, but there isn't really any such thing as breath. There's just this flow of sensations. There isn't a sort of object out there which perdures independent of my experience of it. So it's anatta, and so on. So you sort of deliberately turn your mind to the object of concentration in the light of the lakshanas, probably one at a time, Bhante recommends. He says in that forum that we had with Vajraloka and Madhyamaloka last year, he says that what Vipassana boils down to is reflection on the lakshanas. So any Vipassana practice is really the systematic application of the lakshanas. So you just take the lakshanas, one lakshana at a time, he recommends, over even some period of time, and you apply that to what you're concentrating on. He did say, I should mention, at the same time, that you should also reflect upon the corresponding vimokshamukha, the corresponding samadhi, so that if you're reflecting on... Oh, no, I shouldn't have done this. If you're reflecting on anicca, you should think about animitta samadhi, how you get from the one to the other. If you're reflecting on anatta, you should reflect on the shunyata samadhi. If you're reflecting on dukkha, well, you should reflect on the apranihita samadhi. I did it. I managed it. I didn't have it written down. So you apply these classic formulations about the nature of reality and the experience that ensues once that nature has been grasped, which is what the samadhis amount to, in order to take your meditation one stage further. And you can probably see how that all that would apply, for instance, in visualization practice, especially to the fact that what you just visualized has disappeared back into the blue sky. So I think that the Vinayata Chaitadharmas provide us with something very, very useful indeed as a way of getting into meditation, as a way of working in our meditation, and as a way of applying our meditation so that we move towards realization. And I think that it is probably very, very useful indeed if we all think in terms of some prajna in every session of meditation, as well as, of course, in many other situations. So that's all for today. Just a couple of points. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the Anyata Chaitadharmas, the undetermined Chaitadharmas. There are only four of them, so I might add something else on, but I haven't made up my mind yet. So you'll just have to take it on chance. I would like to make a request that you all make an effort to get here on time. It's a little bit difficult starting to talk when 40 or 50 people are coming in late. I do understand it's a long distance and so on, but it would really help me if you did turn up on time. If you don't, fair enough, but it would help me. And no doubt others whose concentration is broken. So, in 30 minutes' time, well, I've finished 2 minutes early, but at 12 o'clock we'll carry on. But I believe Mahamati has something to say to fill up the 2 minutes.